You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Oh, man.
Oh, it's insanity.
Oh, welcome. Welcome to another week of technology. I'm Meg Riley here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and you're here for another episode of The View. Every month, it is our joy to bring on members of the Black Lives of UU Collective. Oh, do you call yourselves a collective? Is that a fair name?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. And so today, we have Lena and Leslie coming to catch us up on many things, and I'm really interested to hear some of your stories. Lena, do you want to start and share? And there's just always a lot going on, so.
Yeah, I think, so this, you know, view, we decided to talk about the power of narratives. I had recently gone to Creating Change in Chicago, the LGBTQ Task Force Creating Change Conference, and got to connect with a lot of activists on the ground. And many of them, one of the things we talked about was two things. One is this call-out culture of our movement and how it is both necessary and it can be really harsh at times. And we see that internally in the movement with each other, and then externally what it looks like is how are we navigating the ways in which we call people to accountability for how, you know, privileges and different oppressions are showing up in their lives, but while also making room for compassion and grace. And one of the people that I really connected with, you know, talked about how a lot of us in the movement came up through Black churches and were cast out because of their identity as LGBTQ. And so it was really this exploration of so what does that mean for, like, what our understanding of grace is? And Reverend Sekou one time even said, like, elders failed you in showing, you know, this younger generation grace and compassion with regards to sexual orientation and LGBTQ identity. And so, you know, how are we, you know, trying to deal with that, those lessons that we learned both externally and internally in the movement? And I think it's just something that I feel like I've heard echoed from white allies here too is, well, I just, you know, my feelings get hurt a lot in this work. And, you know, I love, Leslie has this t-shirt, what is it, is white feelings are not greater than, you know, Black lives. And I think that, you know, it's how do we walk this line? What are some ways in which we can walk this line to do that better, to have more grace and compassion, and yet not fall short of calling people accountable for things that, you know, they need to be held accountable for. So I think, go ahead.
I was going to say, where have you seen that done well? Where have you seen modeling of
where have I seen that done well?
That has grace. It's a big question, so you might not be able to answer quickly, but I would love examples.
Yeah,
I have a really good example. I think it was about a month ago, BYP 100 in Chicago, out of Chicago, led by Charlene Carruthers, they had an event, and female activists brought to light that one of the male leaders of BYP that was at this event assaulted her. And it was obviously, you know, a difficult moment for them as an organization and also as a movement, just kind of being focused, especially as BYP is, on intersectional work and making sure that the spaces that are there in our movement are safe for people. And they took a really amazing restorative justice approach to what they were going to do. They suspended the leader in question. They had conversations separately with both the woman and the individual. And so their hope was to not have them confront each other, because that is not helpful either, especially in this particular situation, but to specifically work towards a solution that has the aggrieved party in mind. and that whatever solution is reached is what that individual wants. I can share a link that kind of has a, from the Chicago Reader, that has a good kind of rundown on what happened. But I remember when that happened thinking to myself, whoa, this is a very different approach when we talk about, you know, safety beyond policing and what our communities can look like. It really spoke to me, this integrity that BYP showed, and the, you know, the strength and courage that they showed in standing up for this woman, while still recognizing that we needed to hopefully get to a place where this man could be called in eventually after confronting what had happened and his role in it, and you know, how this can work in a restorative justice way. So I would say that was a really good model of that. It's Black Youth Project is what BYP stands for. It's a national organization, but it is headquartered in Chicago. Mm-hmm.
It seems like you also
at the Cleveland gathering that the trans community did some good work, at least from your perspective. It called you in, and you came away recommitted and recharged. And I wondered if that happened in a particular way, those conversations. And I know there was, you know, pain and conflict and all of that too, but I just feel like as much as we can learn from what went well, I'd like to. Sorry, Lena, I was trying to get back to your narrative there, so however you want to pick it up.
Oh, sorry, I didn't realize you were talking to me. I thought you were still talking to Leslie. But yes, I think I was really touched by the trans, a few trans, you know, folks in particular, because, you know, I think it was just reminders as they were calling, you know, saying, like, these are behaviors that cisgender people do that hurt me personally and contribute to my oppression. And I think there's this first level of, like, you know, shock that's like, oh, I didn't know that that was your reality and that I was actively contributing to it by doing this. And so that, you know, then there's this pain and kind of shame that wells up. Not kind of shame, like serious shame, that can be really paralyzing. And I think that for me, you know, I just wept in the corner, and I knew that it was my tears to take care of, and I knew that it was my, you know, my growth and compassion. I knew I was being broken open to more compassion. And so to just kind of let that come in and then to let go of the shame. And I think I actually learned, you know, some of my skills in that from my dad's spiritual teachings around really grounding yourself in love, really grounding yourself in meeting people where they're at. And I think, and that includes yourself, right? So there was a time in middle school where, you know, I had had some bad interactions at school, and I was like, oh, I hate white people. And my dad was like, you can't hate white people. And I was like, you know, so angry about things I saw that, like, grown teachers couldn't see. I was just irate about it. And I was like, how can they can't see this? And, you know, my dad was like, you know, you can't blame people for what they don't know. They just don't know. And he was like, you know, once they know, then you can blame them. But until then, you just can't. And so I think learning how to turn that lesson on your own self can help you bring you out of some of that shame. Because what I've also watched in this movement is at times my own shame or other shame causing them to cause more harm because they're unwilling to, you know, fully say, just own that accountability and just, you know, say, I'm sorry, full stop. I will, you know, I will do better, full stop. You know, like, there's always these, you know, qualifications. I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. I'm sorry if blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, no, like, just own the full responsibility and immensity of whatever privilege it is you're sitting in, and then you know, do, you know, like Maya Angelou says, once you know better, do better. And knowing that there is no perfection, right? Like, I think that that's the other piece is there's, like, we want to hope that there's, like, this end destination, this end game of, well, at some point, I can just, like, stop thinking about all this, right? And it's really not that way, you know? It's just this constant journey. And I think that, yeah, it's hard. And I've really been searching within my own UU theological foundations for some way to really anchor myself in, you know, this compassion and in love to be able to move out of the shame and bring, you know, others along with me. And, you know, I think about we're having some really serious discussions in Minneapolis around misogyny after the Fourth Precinct occupation, and they are internal in the Black community. And I think there are some really profound things happening around that. And just watching the levels at which, you know, Leslie said something really important, which was about listening to the people who have been victims of, you know, whatever it is, and really holding that space for them and not tearing them down. And I think that that happens. I see that paralleled in, like, white UU spaces sometimes of, you know, you see it when, oh, I don't like the tactics that you're doing, or I don't, and really, you know, we're telling stories about victimization, systemic victimization. And so, you know, how can we start to think about, you know, the theological ways that would allow us to really open up that space is something I kind of sit with, you know, the things I think about as a theology nerd.
That's so wonderful. I love that that's what you're thinking about. That's so exciting. I mean, it makes me think, what kind of ritual could we do together? You know, there's a part at the beginning of, there's that book. Oh, gosh. Well, okay, never mind. I mean,
the Bible? Are you thinking of the Bible?
How do we cleanse?
The Bible. It's the Old Testament.
You know, the book.
I'm seeing a parallel with if I may jump in just a moment with my work in the veterans community around moral injury, and there's the importance of the nuance between shame and guilt, and when we talk about it in the veterans community, we talk about shame being the emotion that I'm a bad person, as opposed to guilt where it says I did a bad thing. And shame is a debilitating and a terrible place to grow from. And I don't know if it's even possible. Whereas guilt, you know, is a great, it's frankly a great emotion, and maybe more Unitarian Universalists should experience it. So I think that's what happens to a lot of white people when they wake up and they're like, holy cow, I'm complicit in all this. And then they get stuck in, I'm a bad person, and there's no place to go from that. And it's just, it's not useful, you know. Whereas to say, like, guilt, okay, I did it, now I can't, I see it, I can't unsee it, now it's time to move forward. Right. Is that a helpful analogy?
No, definitely. I think it's really good, and it also goes back to the question of narrative, which is, you know, which narrative is centered in your feelings, right? So if you're centering your own narrative, then you're going to feel shame. If you're centering the narrative of those that are aggrieved, then you're going to feel guilt. And so that's a question we're constantly having to put forth. You know, when Lena was talking about the...
That's an amazing insight. Can I just say that is a really amazing insight about who's centering the narrative?
Yeah, and it's critical, like, across the board. It's critical in doing this work. You know, I have a lot of privilege that I bring to the work that I do, and I work really hard to not center myself and allow other people's narratives, those that are most closely affected by things, to be the center of the work that I do and ensuring that that's the support I'm providing. But there's certainly moments, you know, when Lena talked about the trans community at the convening, you know, having the space that they asked for and organizers were happy to give it to them, to kind of discuss the ways in which the space that was created there, as great as it was, wasn't great for them. And as an organizer of the convening, you know, it's very easy to slip into a narrative that was like, wow, we did so much work. Wow. You know, you don't know what happened behind the scenes and why it ended up the way that it did. But in the end, you know, we have to cut that off because it's not about me in that moment. I wasn't aggrieved. I wasn't hurt. I wasn't feeling unwelcome in this space. And so that is a great lesson for people to understand that it's a humbling experience and it happens to us all the time. And I don't know if being black equips us maybe a little bit more for the humbling, but I know that it's something that we definitely have to like consistently confront. And I think that for white folks, it's often a very uncomfortable and unusual feeling to be in a humble place in that regard when, you know, your intentions are one way and the outcome is another. And we talk all the time about that, about, you know, outcome always outweighing intent. Which I think is real difficult for UUs to get because we tend to be intellectual and intent is so important and there's a lot of focus on that. So yeah, but I do think that your analogy is a really good one, Bob.
This is, I mean, I'm just listening to both of you and saying, this is spiritual maturity. This is like, this is what we all aspire to. And yeah, I think of one of my teachers who said, if you hit someone else's car and then stopped and said to them, but I didn't mean to, then they wouldn't say, oh, well, drive away and let's not call the insurance company then. I mean, of course you didn't mean to, but yeah, it's so easy. I mean, that narrative that you gave of look at all we did, and it is so easy to go there, and there's so much more life if we can drop it, but yeah, this is just such a deep well we're in right now, I feel like, about spiritual narrative, about what we're here to do on the planet, and you know, how I think I'm really interested in how we create ritual to support this kind of maturity. And yeah, so I'm not that we have any listeners now, but later when we do, I'd love to hear if congregations are actively doing rituals to support this kind of clarity of what we're here to do.
Yeah. One of the things...
You go ahead, Aisha, go ahead.
Hopefully I won't get kicked off. In East Shore, where I am now, once a year since Beloved Conversations has started, we've had an entire service about... talking about race, putting race in the forefront. And part of the service is asking each person in the room to write down, the first one was their first memory of race or racial injustice. The following year was something about, like, it was flowers, like their hope or it was very personal, how they, what are they doing to make a difference or how do they see something different. And I think... this year it was something about their hopes for the future. So it's once a year, which is clearly not enough, but it's more than there was before, and this congregation's been there 65 years. So it's a small seed, but it's one that is really powerful, and it's astounding, the conversations just about everything now in the congregation. And it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. What I'm finding is I'm representing a lot for a lot of people. Like suddenly I'm being accused of things. And it's interesting because I'm like, this isn't about what you all think it's about. It's probably about Black Lives Matter and diversity and just that I represent change and difference. And that's an interesting tension because the shame and guilt, we're not even there yet. We need to get there, but we're not even there yet. We're starting with, you know, almost AA. Like we can't solve a problem till we recognize there is one, right? So it's been interesting.
That's interesting, Aisha. I actually went to an event here in Grand Rapids soon after we moved here, and it was like, you know, racism in Grand Rapids, and it was like, I don't know. It was a bunch of stuff that was wrong with it, but they did this similar exercise, kind of like, what was your first memory of racial injustice or, you know, when you became aware of race? And it was really interesting to hear, especially the white people in the room, because each of their stories was really about their feelings. It was like, it was so telling to hear, you know, a woman tell a story about a like black baby doll that, you know, she felt her parents were, you know, not nice to or something like that. It was so about her feelings in that moment. And it was like, just taking that in, and I feel like it's a great place that you can have those kinds of conversations as well. When you see that pop up, you know, take it a little bit further and say, okay, great, I hear what all you guys are saying. Let's go back a little bit and think about where we were centering, where you thought, where your emotions were stirred, why they were stirred there, and how we can replace those centering narratives with something different. Because it takes more than just acknowledgement in these moments. I feel like often we don't go that extra step. We don't take that next place to go to and say, we were talking about this thing, and now let's analyze what we talked about so that we're framing the next part of this in a correct way. Because if we don't do that, we tend to kind of recircle on the same narratives over and over and over again, and we never get to that next step. We have to be able to analyze what we're discussing so that people can really see for themselves about themselves in those moments. So that's really interesting, Aisha. I've had a similar experience.
So I just took a class on multicultural church at Meadville last month, and I made a comment in the class, and at break, a very kind woman who was sitting next to me said, "Can I talk to you about your comment?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "Don't just say sure, because I'm going to tell you something you might not want to hear." And I said, "No, I genuinely do." And she walked me through. She was like, "You said this, and I was so excited, and then you recentered whiteness." And I was like, "Oh my God, I did." You know, and it was kind of like, thank you for being so kind and showing me that, because it's so the air I breathe. You know, if you ask white people, which nobody asked me for a really long time, when did you recognize that you were white and behaved like a white person culturally? That is much later than recognizing, you know, those early feelings of whatever they are. I won't even go into them, but recognizing that I have cultural deficiencies. I am actually located in race. That is a very different question to ask white people. And for many white people, I mean, this is what the teacher said, and it doesn't happen till adulthood. I mean, the identification with our race, I mean, superiority happens much earlier, but actually understanding that we are part of it, that we are whiteness. It's not just like, you know, this neutral thing that we're not part of. So it's some work. So Lena, were you telling beautiful stories. Was there anything else that you're ruminating about right now? Because I feel like I'm sitting getting teachings. Oh, no, see, I just recentered whiteness. That's exactly what I did. That is exactly what I did in that class. I said, "Oh, please go on, because I need it." You know.
Before we go further, we need to identify.
What I'm talking about. Damn it!
Before we go further, we need to identify the racist in the room.
But now we know. Damn it! I'm still white.
Can we create a ritual for Meg? Can we? Is it possible?
I need rituals. Anyway, Lena, you were sharing.
Well, I think I'm actually just going to say that this piece about ritual and like how, like, do people already have rituals that we do, or can we create, you know, UU rituals? I think it's a really, you know, timely question to ask in this time of Lent, in this time of, you know, yeah, I was just talking with a fellow, you know, faith leader, Reverend Ashley Harness from Lindell UCCN. You know, one of the things she talked about was getting ready to preach on repentance. And I thought, wow, like, we really, really don't have any sort of vehicle or ritual about repentance. And therefore, we don't have any redemption, really, you know. And so it's really thinking about that, and I just found this morning it looks like a, you know, actually Reverend Sean Dennison shared it, that it's you know, this 40, you know, they're doing 40 days of repentance for racial justice, and really just starting to look at that and thinking like, okay, where are areas of privilege or areas where I can try to start to do this, you know, for for the next how many ever days I want to. 40 seems like a long time, but you know, maybe it's necessary. And I also live with a housemate who comes from the Jewish tradition, and I remember the first time she handed me a letter, and she was saying, well, it's, you know, it was around Rosh Hashanah, and she was like, this is, we, I think that, I think, is that the one where the atonement, no. Anyways, she, yeah, and so she gave me this letter, and it was just, like, really touching, and she, like, apologized, and I was like, dude, what is this? What are you doing? And, but in the end, we had some really powerful discussions about our friendship, and it brought us much closer together. And so I do think that it will be important for you use, and maybe that is, you know, one of the things that, you know, we start to think about as we do this racial justice work is repentance and redemption, and sort of how we can make that more of an ongoing part of this work that we do, because I think it's really necessary, and I think it can be really powerful for all of us.
And I think that one of the things for back first say thank you, Lena. That's great. And I think one of the other things that we need to remember too is that, you know, in the season of Lent, what, you know, it ends with Easter. So there's this transformation that occurs, a sort of this new life. And I think that's one of the things we also need to remind folks of as well, is that we're not just doing this to make everyone else feel good. This is about are coming into a new world, and I try not to make it seem like centered on me or on whiteness, but like on, like, and everyone going through this process, the whole congregation can come and have be sort of transformed through this process, and that you know, our movement, our larger culture, you know, can be that there is a reward at the end of this. You know, wanting to use sort of Christian language of that, you know, that we're going to go and be transformed into a new life, and that, yeah, and but we have to get through this difficult time. And let me also remind you too that it's 40 days, and you can't count Sundays. That's the other thing about Lent.
I didn't know you didn't count Sundays. Interesting.
That's so long.
I think finding ritual that fits us is what's really important. I was part of the racial cultural diversity work that went on in the 90s in the UU world, and I think part of the problem with it was that a Lutheran, Joe Barnt, was in charge of Crossroads, the interfaith group we were working with, and that's, Lutheranism is a confessional culture, and Unitarian Universalism is not a confessional culture, and It theologically didn't fit for a lot of people, theologically. So, it's figuring out what does. Because there has to be an element of confession for transformation to occur, but how does that work differently for us?
And I think I see a connection here back to the power of narrative, right? I mean, it gets back to what Leslie brought up of, whose narratives are you centering? And I think UUs are really good at centering their own narratives. And so, you know, I think repentance is a decentering of, you know, your narrative. It's a focus on, you know, the people you've hurt and the ways, you know, that you need to repent for. And I really think that, again, yeah, it's the power of narrative cannot be underscored. And I think, you know, I'm going to speak on this panel at my alma mater, and it's the title is there a right way to protest? And the whole framing of that is like, what? And when they first asked me to do this, I was like, oh, no, like, that's just like, no, because, you know, it is, it's like, what, because the narrative that they're centering there is right, like a very white, very privileged, very, you know, it's so shrouded in that. And so I'm sitting here thinking about these things that we're talking through, and the pushback that they got from the community is absolutely in line with, that's not even the right question to ask, because it's the wrong narrative in these times where people are being killed, you know, so.
Yeah, Lena, that's a great segue to kind of delve a little bit into the Flint narrative, which I wanted to talk about a little bit. Which is that often, and this is something I think we've run into as part of the Black Lives UU collective, is this desire to make this movement digestible, right? to make it easy to explain, to make it, you know, for lack of a better term, just more in line with like a political process, which would be sound bites and specific leaders and specific points that everybody agrees with, you know, all of those things that, you know, are part of the quote-unquote establishment way of doing movement work. And part of the challenge that this movement has brought to all of our lives is questioning that, right? So as we move through and look at all of these other issues that pop up, it's really important to look at narrative, who's centered, who is putting these stories together, and is there clearly a desire to make it easy to digest. So I bring Flint into the conversation because I think those that have heard about the crisis in Flint, the water crisis in Flint, have certainly heard a, not even just to say one-sided, but certainly a short-sighted version of what's happening in Flint and in Michigan, generally speaking. So on the outside, you know, even the hashtag Flint water crisis, it seems like something happened, water is bad, people need clean water, right? That sounds like a really cool thing to put a bow on. You can buy some water, you can send it, you can say we need to clean this water up and get people clean water, and it sounds like something that people can rally around. But you know, when we look further into the issues that Flint is facing, we see a much more complex story, and we see a much more complex narrative that no one is lifting up. So we see connections from this water crisis to the emergency management system that is in place here in Michigan. So we see, we know that 50% of all Black people in this state are under, are living in a city that's under emergency management. And for those who don't know what happens in emergency management is the vote and the will of the people is completely usurped. So the mayor, the city council, anybody that's an elected official, all of their power is taken away once an emergency management decree occurs. So we're talking about, this is a voting rights issue now. You know, we're talking about 50% of Black people in this state whose voting rights have been completely taken away. They have no control over what happens in their municipalities, and they have no control over the people that are making those decisions because they're not elected officials anymore. We can dig a little bit deeper and we can see a direct connection between the privatization of water. We see that the state of Michigan sits in and around a third of natural water reserves, right, in the world. And yet we have a country here, I mean a city here, that is without potable water that they can even drink. It's a third world problem happening in a first world country, and we have yet to see a first world response to it. You know, we haven't seen the Army Corps of Engineers hit the ground so that they can test everybody in Flint so that they can ensure that clean water is being had. These are mechanisms that our country has done elsewhere, yet here in our country, we don't see those things occurring. And there has been another narrative that I think is really important to lift up, which is the lack of ability for folks to understand that the people on the ground and the people that live in Flint are dealing with this problem. They've been screaming about this problem for a very long time. This isn't new to them. The information isn't new to them. The effects aren't new to them. And there's been this framing of like, oh, this thing happened and now this one study came out and now we know about it. When in reality, the state has known for a long time. The people have been making lots of noise about it for years and years. And they're building consensus and collaboration between different cities and different movements on the ground.
Hold on a second, Leslie. You've shocked me here. Years and years this has
been
going on?
Years and years this has been going on. The issue of water in this state and water quality in this state and access to water. We had just, you know, as long ago as 10 years ago, Detroit has been seeing consistent water shutoffs, and we've seen access to water being done. And also we've seen liens put on property that have to do with water bills. And so what happens is we have corporations and the state coming in and taking property from Black and brown poor people to gain access to water rights, especially when these properties butt against water access. It's been a huge problem across this entire state. So there's a lot of larger scale narratives, and when you start to connect the pieces together, you see a much bigger story than let's send water to Flint. And so I always want to lift up and kind of hopefully ask folks to look a little bit deeper. Whenever you see a problem that people are dealing with, it's always more than the problem that you might see, you know, pushed forward. It's easier to say, hey, let's put some water in a truck and send it. It's a lot harder to say, wow, let's look at the larger pieces that are in play here. Talk about how emergency management came to be in this state. Talk about the power that that takes away from people. Talk about the general narrative of what emergency management means, because what that means is the state and the governor has said that this, mostly in all these cities, black leadership is not equipped to run their city, right? That's what they're saying. They have decided that they've decreed it and they're sending someone in to manage these municipalities. And I question that narrative from the start. I think it's rooted in white supremacy, it's rooted in anti-blackness, and it leads to situations like we're seeing in Flint, and we'll continue to see, not just in Flint, but we see it in Mississippi, we see it in New Orleans, we see it in Pennsylvania. It's not anything that's new. But I do think what's unique about this situation here is this emergency management piece, because it has been wielded with such ferocity in this state and to great effect to the benefit of private corporations. So I just wanted to lift that up. I've been spending a lot of time. I'll be back. Yeah, so one corporation I would definitely lift up for people to look into is Viola Water, and they are a private water company that has spent untold money and effort and pressure to privatize water systems across the globe, not just here. They're actually a French company, and they are at the heart of a lot of these decision-making processes that we see in the state of Michigan gaining access to these fresh water reserves that I mentioned earlier. And they're, you know, behind the scenes, you know, of all of this takeover of water, how it works for them. And I don't want to say that, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I really am not. But I will say this. I will say that if I went into my work in Flint thinking that this was a mistake, and an unintentional one, perhaps, the lack of response to the crisis has shown me that that's definitely not the case, and that this was absolutely intentional, and that you know, a decision was made by many people that the people and the children of Flint, Michigan, don't matter. They were a calculated casualty, and they were an okay one to let go. And we've seen that in the state many places. We've seen it with the education system in Detroit. Well, we can't do anything about it. Let's just write it off. You know, this idea of letting pieces of black and brown communities go because they're not worth saving. And it's always a question of cost over justice. Always. It always comes back to that. And I don't think that that narrative, the cost over justice in the Flint story, is being told nearly enough.
The pieces that I have been read have been staggering about the decisions and how they were made with regards to money. Is there any, so the state, I don't quite understand the power structure here. The state just gets to decide and call that state of emergency. That's a state level decision, and any state could do that?
Well, I don't know if any state can do it, but here in Michigan, they have the power to do that. It's something that they've been putting in place. And again, it's the pushing of this narrative of this city can't handle itself. This city's leadership that the people have voted in are not able to, you know, are not fiscally responsible. They don't know what's needed, you know, and it's easy to say that. But when you look at a place like Flint and its leadership, we're talking about a city that lost 50% of its population in the last 20 years. I don't know any municipality or any leadership that can deal with that situation and not have fiscal stumbling blocks. It's just a matter of economics. And to frame it in this concept of it's these people that are the problem and they can't do their job, and so we need to send somebody in to fix it, it's just false. It's just a false narrative completely. And they've sold it all over the state. So, yeah, so that's where we are with it, and it's really just becoming evident. I see Flint as a flashpoint, but not the end of this story at all. Much like Ferguson was not the end of the story with police brutality. So, yeah.
So, what kind of organizing is going on there? When you were there, were you part of a movement? is national attention coming in from Black Lives Matter or other? I mean, I know there is on media, but I wonder on the ground what it's like.
Yeah, so I've been working with a local organizer named Nayira Sharif, and she works with the Flint Defense Fund, and she's been working on the ground on a lot of these issues. Specifically, they were started to deal with the Flint Emergency Management Decree and kind of overturning that. So obviously, as the effects of the emergency management come to light, they shift and they start talking about some other things as well. And so I've been working directly with her. She's an amazing organizer, but she's really taxed. And so recently, they've started putting together kind of a steering team. And I was lucky enough, I kind of called a meeting of all of them on Tuesday and invited in some national folks to just sit at a table for about 5 hours and just kind of really just like tell us what's going on, tell us what their efforts are, talk about the different things that are happening to them, and not come up with solutions, because certainly we don't have any, as national folks, don't have solutions. You know, one of the big things in this organizing is that really the communities we go into, they really do have the answers to their problems. They always do. Like, I've never encountered a community that hasn't fully been equipped and ready and able to answer the problems that they have. They need resources. They need support. They don't need answers. And so that was really the goal of the conversation, to give us some framework and see some places where those of us outside of Flint can plug in and support them in ways that they need. Some resource-wise, some amplification-wise, some other ways as well, organization-wise. So they have named their coalition. It's called Flint Rising. You guys can follow them on Twitter, I think, right now. And you'll see more as they start. It's embryonic right now in terms of the coalition. They're still building it and deciding what their mission is going to be and how they're going to govern and things like that. But it's definitely taking shape. And, you know, when I say that the state is doing nothing, you know, I went on tours on Tuesday morning of different mechanisms for getting water, which I can't quite describe this, the concept of, I don't think people quite understand. If you wake up in the morning, you don't know where you're going to get water from, okay? There's no central place that is logging this information. There's nowhere to tell you where water is going to be at any given time. So you kind of just have to, like, close around and call around and see different places that might have it. And so there's a state mechanism for it, which is the fire departments, okay? And that poses a couple of issues. It's run by the National Guard, and so if you're undocumented, that's a potential point of conflict for you. If you have any issues with law enforcement generally, whether it's emotionally triggering or you have an arrest warrant or all sorts of reasons why you don't want to come in contact with those folks, that's concerning. And they're only giving one case of water per household. Per visit, per day, basically. So think about that for washing, for eating, for cleaning, for everything. One case of water per day. Go ahead, Lena.
Yeah, I was just going to chime in that Danny from Black Clergy United for Change, they took a trip there just this past week and came back with stories about the very personal impact of this, you know, and Danny was sharing with us a story last night of a mother who the fire department he said to their neighborhood once a week. And on Sunday, she was getting ready for church, getting her kids ready for church, and she missed the drop-off. And she actually, the truck was still on the street. She ran down the street and said, "Hey, can I get, you know, my water? I was getting ready for church." And the firefighter was like, "No, you have to wait till next week." And he was right there and could have just given it to her or just, you know, walked it to her house. You know, she has a 3-year-old son that can't speak yet. And, like, I think this piece about, you know, again, the narratives and, like, the power of, like, disposable people, like, this idea of disposable people, all the reports that there have been zero translators sent in. So you have lots of undocumented workers who don't know what's going on, who don't know, you know, the how dangerous the water is, and ICE, there's been reports of ICE baiting people with water to get them. And, like, this is the sort of thing that, like, tears at my soul, right? And this, I think, is where I also don't believe in conspiracy theories. I think there's this thought that, like, conspiracy theories are, like, maliciously intended, and like, you know, there's this frame, and so people can say, well, clearly people aren't that bad. But what people don't, I think the thing that I, the line, the thorough line that I can thread through all of this is the money making mechanism. It's that where there is money to be made by privatizing a water supply, for instance, people will act incredibly, you know, immorally. And that is what we're seeing. We're seeing sort of this manufactured crisis so that people can now come in and make a case for privatizing the water supply. And in the meanwhile, there is all of this collateral damage, who are real people that are also disproportionately black and brown bodies. And you can trace a thorough line from that to the ways in which, you know, our criminal justice system work, to the ways in which a lot of structural racism happens in this nation. And I think that's, you know, again, when you have this narrative of, oh, something bad happened, it's kind of like a natural disaster. It's not like a natural disaster, actually. It's not. And what are the narratives that we are coming up with that can push back against that? And, you know, the other thing in listening and thinking about this theme of narratives as well is that piece that's so critical that Leslie lifted up, is that people in their own communities know the solutions and have the solutions. And we see this time and time again. We see this here in Minneapolis whenever we hold like community meetings at NOC or at other places and we say, what are solutions? People say things like the police shouldn't be able to just shoot people, right? And then I'm like, that's a policy solution when you think about it. It's a policy solution that argues against excessive use of deadly force. But you have to put it in these terms. Otherwise, it's like you have to speak this incredibly, you know, difficult language that's like policy. It's like legalese policy-ese, you know? And if you don't speak it, the people think, you know, you don't, then you're just not coming up with real solutions. But actually, the people know the solutions. And I think that it should be on the elected officials and on the people in power to take half a step outside of their, like, blinding, like, language and cultural barriers to be able to really listen to the solutions, because a lot of times these solutions make the most sense, would not be incredibly difficult to implement, but you come up with whose narratives are being listened to and whose voices are being centered, and it is not the people's voices that time and time again that are being centered, and you see this in Flint.
Absolutely, and it's so, you know, I'll tell one quick anecdote, which is that, you know, one of the things I've been really frustrated with, Friends is almost 60% black community, and yet every article I see, every piece that I read, I see white faces connected with this crisis, and it's been really interesting to me. And one of the first moms that were kind of lifted up, I think her name is Melissa McBride, she's a great, you know, what happened to her is very true and all of that stuff, but the story behind why she was the one that was kind of put forth as this study was that she had insurance, she had the means to pay for testing that had to be done, and black moms didn't have those resources to do that. So even in the telling of this story and getting it out there, we see, again, privilege being brought into the narrative and centered because just by necessity. That was the first road to getting this information together and collecting it and doing it. You know, it wasn't enough to have anecdotal stories and medical records and all of this stuff. We need, you know, the need for the data to be quote unquote clean in terms of what was being reported was necessary. And I appreciate that. It's true. It's very necessary in narratives like this. But when we look at why this specific person was the narrative, it's really indicative of when we look at how narratives get formed and how they get put together and how people digest them. It's really critical to think about all of those kind of behind the scenes things.
It's been amazing for me to watch all that's been going on in Flint and just, you know, and people being handed out bottles of water. And I just think of like all the other times and all the other ways I use water every day. You know, it's a city of 100,000 people, and you know, when we had you know, we had some plumbing problems on our street, and they ran like above ground hoses. And I understand it's winter, and there might be an issue, but like handing out bottles of water, like, you know, isn't going to cut it. Never mind like the other environmental problems with that, you know, but it's just, I mean, there's just all those things. I just see, you know, those truckloads of people doing it, and I just, my mind sort of explodes, kind of going like, I can't believe that we're still doing this. This is it, you know. Heartbreaking.
And it's been the people that have been doing that. I mean, I gave this narrative of the fire department with one case, and we contrast that with next place we went to was a church that's giving out water. They're giving 6 cases per address. She's like, the woman running it said to me, I don't even care if it's a correct address. They just give me any address. If you have an address, you get 6 cases. If 2 of you have 2 addresses, then you're going to get 12. And they're providing things like, you know, nursery water, because you can't make formula with spring water. You have to have distilled or nursery water to do that. So these are small things that you don't think about, because public assistance and WIC have determined that ready-made formula is not too expensive for moms to have. You know, they don't get that. They get powdered formula. And you would think that a state mechanism would say, if you have a Flint zip code, you can now get ready-made formula. But no, they're requiring each mom to go to the agency to request to add ready-made water onto their system. And so these are the things that lead me to understand that this is a deliberate problem, and that these people have been designated as disposable, because these are easy solutions that the people, as I said, this is not my brilliance, it's their brilliance. I talk to them. We just wish that they would say, if you have a Flint zip code, that you automatically, when they swipe your card at the grocery store, you can get ready-made formula. Seems like a pretty simple solution for a pretty significant problem for the youngest and most vulnerable members of this community, and yet hasn't been done. So
I love that you convened a national group to you know, make something like that into a campaign today. You know, I mean, I picture the resources you brought into the room, and it's phenomenal. I guess any sense that I had that I might be too paranoid kind of fell apart with Katrina. I mean, you know, that just was like, okay, no paranoia I could have made this up, because it's yeah.
No, and Katrina is a great example of how, when we look to the future of these crises and who's benefiting, who isn't, what recovery means in these areas. We see this happening in Detroit already. I guarantee you, we will see this happening in Flint. It will be a means to gentrification and water privatization that excludes Black and Brown and poor white people. And we see this time and time and time again.
Right. Is the UU Church doing anything in Flint? Talk to them at all?
No.
Danny made some connections, and he had said they're not doing anything right now. It was his sense, but there was interest in building, and we were talking about pulling a contingent from Minneapolis and going, which, Leslie, I was going to connect with you about and see when you'll be there next. And the thing that strikes me about all of this, too, as well, we're discussing this, is, like, you know, like the GM plant, right, got their own water, over a year ago. Mm-hmm. And so, like when you unravel the layers, again, it just becomes so enraging.
And the part that's really heartbreaking is the intent is to make money. People are no longer at the center of any of these decisions. And intent isn't going to save us in the end. And I think that's the part that's so really, it's dystopia. Like I put on Facebook, it feels like we're living in a dystopian novel. We're living the Hunger Games. We're living almost the Handmaid's Tale when you look at all the women's rights, just to throw that in. But the intent is to make money and to make sure corporations are taken care of. So really, the intent is being carried out. We need to put people, brown, black, poor people, at the center of the intent.
Amen. Thank you so much for this week, Leslie and Lena. We'll see you again on St. Patrick's Day, I think. So we're really excited to always hear what's going on. Next, we'll have the two presidential candidates for the UUA, Sue Phillips and Allison Miller, here. Joanna, who was on the nominating committee and can't have an opinion, will do the interviews for those. And meanwhile, thanks so much. And I hope by next week we're going to have this technological thing figured out. It's not for lack of trying.
Inshallah.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.